From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Almost 2 weeks, and Baghdad still stands defiant. This was not the rosiest scenario of Donald Rumsfeld's war plan. But Rumsfeld's plan for Iraq, says investigative reporter Seymour Hersh, was not the plan many uniformed U.S. military ever wanted. Now U.S. troops are short on supplies and hungry for reinforcements, and frustration in the Pentagon builds. Tonight on Point, Seymour Hersh and the war in Washington over the war in Iraq. We begin tonight with an emerging rift between the Bush administration and elements of the Republican Party. Walter Pincus covers national security affairs for The Washington Post. I asked him to describe the nature of the GOP rift.
Well, I think you had sort of battle number one back in the summer last year when the original plan of Vice President Cheney and Defense Secretary Rumsfeld was to plan for the Iraq War to take place, perhaps unilaterally if necessary, in the fall. But Secretary Powell stepped in, convinced the president that you had to go to the UN at first. And in that, he had an alliance with some former senior executives in the previous Bush administration.
Bush won, the president's father.
Right. And it really started off with the former national security advisor, Brent Scowcroft, writing an article in the Wall Street Journal suggesting the UN, or he was backed up by a later article by former Secretary of State James Baker. And all that got together and helped, and they went to the UN over the objections of Vice President Cheney and the Defense Secretary.
And now you're writing, Walter Pincus, that within the Republican camp, in and around the Bush administration, there is criticism of Vice President Cheney, of Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, of his deputy Paul Wolfowitz, that their advice to President Bush has been wrong and even dangerous to long-term U.S. national interests. What's the substance behind that kind of charge?
The substance is it's actually a reactivation of the argument from last summer, and that is you can't do these things alone, that the United States is not going to bring democracy to the Middle East at the point of a gun. And that in the process of moving toward the war starting last month, there was a lot of alienation of our traditional European allies, the French, the Germans, and putting in doubt the future of not just the United Nations and American participation, but also NATO and the European Union.
How serious is this breach, this debate, this split within the Republican ranks, Walter Pincus?
It could be fairly serious because there are Republicans who supported the current president who are unhappy in the direction that they're taking us, particularly in the foreign policy field. And they are making their voices heard quietly right now, but it could break out in public. And if things go wrong, and that is if they've sort of given up on the war, the United States is going to win the war, they're supporting the war effort, but now the fight has moved to what happens post-war and whether, in effect, the development of post-war Iraq is going to be left in the hands of the Pentagon, which is what Secretary Rumsfeld and his allies want, or whether the State Department is going to have the upper hand and bring in the United Nations and make this a multilateral operation rather than a close to unilateral one.
So that debate is still to come, but what about the prosecution of the war itself? Have the opening days discredited Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz? Have they been knocked back a bit, or are they still high in the saddle in Washington?
Well, I think a lot depends on how things turn out. Certainly, it's pretty well established that the people around the defense secretary and Vice President Cheney himself, who went on television and talked about not a cakewalk, but certainly talked about it being much easier than it appears to be, talked about the Republican guards, probably some of them surrendering and giving a really overall an impression that has not been borne out, even though the war's only gone on for less than 2 weeks. But we're taking the kinds of casualties and the appearance that we may have to fight door to door in the major cities of Iraq. It's something that the public was not led to expect.
So is this group within the Republican Party that's so disgruntled prepared to see Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz continuing to lead the civilian side of the defense? Can they adjust, or are they so wedded to what brought us here that they wouldn't be satisfactory leaders going forward there?
Well, I think what you're getting is, to be honest, a fight for the mind of the president. The argument, as one of them put it rather brutally, was, is he going to be made to realize that he's gotten some bum advice from these people who thought they could do it alone? And is he going to continue letting them set the standard for what the United States does and do post-war Iraq alone, if we have to, our way, the U.S. way, without bringing in outside help? And are they going to carry on, which has been part of some of their agenda, and that is to begin moving toward countries like Syria, Iran, maybe North Korea, militarily, just going it alone?
And are these dissatisfied Republicans, Republicans with clout, with teeth? Do they include Colin Powell?
Colin Powell's caught in the middle, as one person told me. He is between the traditional rock and a hard place. He is a good soldier. He is saluted. And after the UN attempt apparently failed, although there's a big argument, had you waited 30 days or 45 days, you would have had a French and a much more unified UN with you. But Colin Powell became the person who took the message to the UN that we're going ahead anyway. And right now he is doing his best in public to support the president wholeheartedly. But behind the scenes, some of his senior officials are fighting this new battle to bring the UN into the post-war world and to slow down the idea that militarily we're so powerful we can get our way in any argument from here on in.
And do they have powerful allies? Who are we talking about here? Is this still Scowcroft? Is this
senior,
Father Bush?
Senior officials who were in the president's father's cabinet, were in his top security positions, and one of the few people who could turn the president away from Cheney or away from Rumsfeld to a more multilateral approach to the world that follows. These are people who are trying to find the right time to get the former president to talk to his son.
Walter Pincus, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Walter Pincus covers national security affairs for The Washington Post. He spoke with us earlier from Washington. Before the first cruise missile of the war fell on Baghdad, a coterie of powerful politicians and appointees in Washington dreamed the Iraqis might surrender with little resistance. They haven't. They hoped the worst of the war might be over by now. It isn't. And in the pause, as U.S. troops in the desert wait for supplies and reinforcements, the story of a fierce war before the war is tumbling out in Washington this week. Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Seymour Hersh reports that top uniformed officers in the U.S. military fought and lost a battle with civilian bosses over how the war in Iraq should be prosecuted. The generals wanted overwhelming force, reports Hersh. Vice President Dick Cheney, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, and his deputy Paul Wolfowitz wanted a lighter, faster, cheaper deployment. They got it. And now, despite the upbeat briefings, Seymour Hersh reports intelligence sources who say the war is at a stalemate and long simmering tensions between civilian Rumsfeld and the military brass are boiling over. Is this just the inevitable finger-pointing for a difficult first 2 weeks of war, or is there a fundamental rift between civilian and military leaders of the U.S. armed forces? Was a high-concept ideology, has it, left U.S. troops in the lurch? Or is this just second-guessing too early in the game? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. His latest article, Offense and Defense, the battle between Donald Rumsfeld and the Pentagon, appears this week in the New Yorker magazine. Good evening and welcome. Welcome back, Seymour Hersh.
Yeah, glad to be back.
It's great to have you. Seymour Hersh, there's an awful lot you lay out in this article, and now, in the days since you sent it to press for the New Yorker, there are reports crawling up the walls about uniform military dissatisfaction with the status of the war and the planning for the war. Take us to the heart of what you found in your conversations. What's the core conflict or argument here?
Well, there's a couple of core conflicts, but one of the basic ones is that the officers who do the planning, the problem is the officers in the Pentagon and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Joint Staff, as it's called, these are the guys who represent all the services and do a lot of planning and all of those forward-looking things the military does. And they've been involved in war planning, intense war planning around the clock in Iraq, I'd say for 12 years. But certainly late last summer, they began to go. It was clear that the president wanted to go. I don't know if we'll ever find out exactly how serious he was about the UN or not.
Mm-hmm.
But they began the plan in earnest, and over the course of the next 6-8 months, at least six times, I write this planning group, and these are guys that one thing the military can do is they can move an army from the continental United States to a war zone. They know how to do it. We're not just talking about men and guns. We're talking about the food and the toilet paper.
The works.
And the portable toilets, whatever you need to get an army going. And they have elaborate procedures for doing this. And one of the things they did is six times until March, they formally went to the SecDef, Mr. Rumsfeld, and they were told to make it a redo, he said. And he refused to give them the army the number of men they wanted.
But of course, that this wasn't just about tactical issues of how much toilet paper and tanks and Johnny houses to send. There's been a deep debate going on within the military, with Donald Rumsfeld pushing very hard for reform for this lighter, faster, sleeker, high-tech military. Many people in the armed forces didn't want it. Is this an inevitable outcome? He didn't reach a resolution. You had a divided house with the civilians perhaps on one side and uniformed guys on the other, and now we're at war, and that unresolved conflict is in our laps.
That's an element. This is much more complicated than simply a question about tactics and how the next generation of the armed forces are going to look. Certainly, you're absolutely right. Rumsfeld and others before him wanted to are unhappy with particularly the Army's love for tank units, big, slow, cumbersome tanks and Humvees and armored vehicles. And Rummy, the lesson they learned, they thought they learned in Afghanistan, was a lot of bombing and some special forces and some local aid, and you can pull off anything. You can bring down a government. And so that was that element. They had the experience of the success, although I'm not sure in the long run it's a success, in Afghanistan. You had the ideology, at least the point of view of Rumsfeld, that we do want a smaller and one of the other issues there is with a smaller army, there's money to spend for other things that are dear to Rumsfeld, one of them being national missile defense, for sure. And you also had this overwhelming sense that he and a few, the ruling class in Washington, this little cocoon of people that make policy here, they all agreed that there was just no way, once we hit the field and showed our muscle, that Saddam wouldn't run, the Republican Guard would crack, and the Shiites would whoop for pleasure and run to help us fight Saddam, and Ahmad Chalabi and his group of expats would come in and take over the government happily. Let's put it this way: Donald Rumsfeld really thought we were going to Paris, and we'd be kissing women and getting flowers, and instead we may find ourselves in Mogadishu.
And that none of that has happened yet. But I have to say, Seymour Hersh, the Pentagon, Rumsfeld, General Myers, and others are flatly contradicting almost every element at the top level of what you've got here. They're saying the war is going fine. The battle plan is brilliant. There is no debate here. These reporters are just running around talking with a few of the 1,000 colonels at the Pentagon. This is all overblown.
Well, the light's been at the end of the tunnel before in our history. One of the things I think common sense would tell us, you have a Secretary of Defense that says everything is wonderful. You got a president that keeps on talking as he did. I was just reading with, my mouth agape. He's pledging a better life for Iraqis yesterday and wherever he was, whatever army base he's in. We now have a president that can't basically go in the public anymore. He's got to go from army base to VFW halls. Try and make that speech at Harvard Square, Mr. President, and see what would happen, or even throw out a baseball. And so we're back to that. We're back to the four-star generals and the guys running the government telling us everything's fine, and the rest of us are simply watching and seeing what we see.
Seymour Hersh, stand by. We're going to hear a lot and learn a lot tonight. We're glad you're with us. We're talking about civil war, practically, at the Pentagon, light versus might, and the bitter battle over the war plan for Iraq, the Rumsfeld juggernaut versus the uniformed military. Is this finger-pointing, blame-shifting, scapegoating for a less-than-perfect first 2 weeks of war, or do we have a real fundamental rift in the leadership of the U.S. military? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back with Seymour Hersh. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about something approaching civil war at the Pentagon, light versus might in strategy, and the bitter battle over the war plan for Iraq. Our guest tonight is Seymour Hersh, investigative journalist, Pulitzer Prize winner, writer now for The New Yorker, who has been delivering one tough story after another. He paints a very tough picture of what's going on in the Pentagon and what's going on in the field right now. He quotes intelligence, senior intelligence officials calling the situation militarily in Iraq right now a stalemate. So, have Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and Cheney hijacked the U.S. military with a futuristic concept that doesn't work? Or are stodgy military stick-in-the-muds using the difficulty of war to whack at a reformist Secretary of Defense? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I want to hear just a little bit from a tough press conference this afternoon where Secretary Rumsfeld and General Myers were hitting back at criticism of the war plan in Iraq.
My view of those reports, and since I don't know who you're quoting, who the individuals are, is that they're bogus. I don't know how they get started, and I don't know how they've been perpetuated, but it's not been by responsible members of the team that put this all together. They either weren't there, or they don't know, or they're working another agenda, and I don't know what that agenda might be. It is not helpful to have those kind of comments come out when we got troops in combat, because first of all, they're false. They're absolutely wrong. They bear no resemblance to the truth. And it's just harmful to our troops that are out there fighting very bravely, very courageously.
Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Myers, this afternoon alongside Donald Rumsfeld. We're joined tonight by Seymour Hersh, looking at his big article in The New Yorker this week, Offense and Defense, and the big split in the Pentagon between reformist civilian leadership, and now U.S. military and intelligence sources he quotes, and others have quoted in recent days, saying, we did not go to Iraq with the right plan, with the right stuff. Seymour Hersh, if you will, stand by for just a moment. I want to bring into our conversation John Diamond. He's Pentagon correspondent for USA Today. He's been with us nearly every night since the war began, giving us the view from the Pentagon. John Diamond, you must see the heat and fire from this conflict exploding all around you there. There's an awful lot of response to it in today's briefing.
I had a front row seat, and it was getting a little warm in that room tonight. There's no doubt about it. General Myers was exercised. I think that a lot, though, of what went on, although it looked spontaneous, was rehearsed. I think that much of the criticism has been addressed at Rumsfeld, and Myers made a deliberate effort to take on the criticism as a symbolic show that there are elements of the uniform military that stand behind this plan. What was interesting was that he took on the TV generals, the retirees such as Barry McCaffrey and Wesley Clark, who have been saying very bluntly that there is simply not enough force in Iraq to get the job done.
Barry McCaffrey saying their assumptions were wrong.
And that they made errors in execution in going ahead. I mean, it's not just a question of whether the plan was flawed. It's a question of whether the plan was even executed. Because, of course, as Cy Hersh is writing, there were critical decisions made to go ahead with the war without this force of 62,000 that was to be up in Turkey.
This is the 4th Division that should have or was planned to come through Turkey.
There are now about 40,000 U.S. combat troops around south of Baghdad. Had that division been in place, there would be more like 55,000 troops in two different directions coming at Baghdad, a major difference in how that battle would be unfolding.
John Diamond, Cy Hersh quotes intelligence officials describing the situation now in Iraq in quite bleak terms. This official saying it is now, this is a former intelligence official, unnamed, saying it is now a stalemate in Iraq, and the only way out is back, which I read to mean retreat. This is not what we're hearing at the Pentagon.
It's impossible for me to assess from my seat here in Washington what's going on there. One of the new buzz phrases that's emerged in this war is the phrase the tipping point. And it's the idea that you could have what looks like a stalemate go on for a week or two or four, and suddenly it all reaches critical mass and the whole Iraqi military edifice crumbles. There is word tonight of a major offensive beginning now involving U.S. forces pushing towards Baghdad, and it's really hard to imagine the Iraqi force with all its disadvantages stopping that U.S. advance. The problem does become acute when you get into the cities and the street fighting starts. So it is difficult to assess, but there's no doubt that there's a major rift between the army and the civilians in the Pentagon. And one of the interesting things that's emerging from this, of course, it's not just TV pundits, it's the officers in the field who are complaining. It's three-star General Wallace who's saying that the military failed to properly assess the fighting power of the Iraqi military. And there's sort of a holdover from the Vietnam War going on here, and it was in play today at the Pentagon, which is that there are some Army generals now who were young lieutenants back in Vietnam who have vowed ever since that war that they're not going to lie. They're not going to become overly rosy in their assessment of what's going on in the field. And that essentially is what General Wallace was doing. And what he got today from the Pentagon was basically a gag order. And we're reporting in tomorrow's paper that he was rebuked, roundly rebuked, dressed down by Tommy Franks, the four-star commander, in a teleconference that got wide circulation in the Army ranks, and many officers have been coming to Wallace's defense privately.
John Diamond, thanks for joining us with that report from the Pentagon tonight.
You're welcome.
John Diamond is Pentagon correspondent for USA Today. We're joined by Cy Hirsch tonight, and he is looking at the battle in the Pentagon over the war plan for Iraq. It's tough, tough conflict going on right inside the U.S. military itself. Can you imagine that Donald Rumsfeld may have jammed an insufficient war plan down the throats of the Joint Chiefs? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Seymour Hirsch, you hear there, again, the Pentagon today describing the position of the battle, the war in Iraq, as approaching a tipping point where we will go from what may look like a stalemate to presumably a sudden and dramatic U.S. successes against the regime in Baghdad. You're asserting in your article nothing like that, that it's a stalemate not pushing dynamically toward a change.
Well, I quote somebody saying that who knows an awful lot and has been around a long time and knows what's going on, and I'm certainly hearing a different account from my friends. And you know, I've been around this town a long time, and my friends, the people I know, just have a slightly less optimistic. The war plan isn't great, isn't perfect, as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs says, and it's quite flawed. And we were stunned, the United States was stunned by the resistance of the Shia and also the Fedayeen. And also, don't forget, we have both the Iranian and Iraqi Hezbollah, longtime haters of Saddam, having publicly announced they support it. We have a group of pretty wild bunch of guys, terrorists known as al-Dawa,
Shiites in the south.
Yeah, well, they were linked to Shiites, and they were linked to in Lebanon to the bombing of the American the Marine barracks. Remember, over 200 men were killed.
The U.S. had hoped to have them as allies against Saddam Hussein.
Absolutely, we not only hoped to, we were planning to put them, give them representation on the new constitutional government that Ahmad Shalabi was going to come and lead. We had quite a trifecta going here. You know, if you think about it. We were going to hit Iraq with America, which had been, in many Iraqis' eyes, had been responsible for the sanctions that, whether fairly or not, Saddam certainly had a role in it, but certainly the life in post Gulf War, first war Iraq, has been pretty brutal, largely due to the sanctions. We also had the Brits, who were, of course, infamous in Iraq for the Ottoman Empire. And then the third was Ahmad Shalabi. This Iraqi leader that we have designated by the neocons, who hasn't been in Iraq, I think, since 58.
The Iraqi exile.
Yeah.
Seymour Hirsch, you describe a scene, I guess, in the Pentagon. It was a stunning scene to me, reported to you, where the Army Chief of Staff, General Eric Shinseki, is sitting in front of Donald Rumsfeld, and apparently they're having some portion of this fundamental debate about reform and whether the military can move to this lighter, faster, higher tech style of warfare. And it describes, you describe Donald, one of your sources describing Donald Rumsfeld staring at the Joint Chiefs of Staff and waving his hand and saying to the, I'm sorry, to General Eric Shinseki, and waving his hand, I guess, at the general and saying, are you getting this yet? Are you getting this yet? It sounds like a very frustrated Donald Rumsfeld, but potentially a very unhappy General Shinseki getting that kind of interaction from his civilian chief.
In front of junior officers. That's the point. The point is that you know he's Secretary of Defense. He's entitled to get mad at one of the Joint Chiefs. But what upset the people was that they had to witness it. I also quote another senior general as saying that he told all of his juniors, the 1 and 2 stars. He's more senior than that. When you go see this Secretary of Defense, you better go in there and be prepared to take off your stars and leave them there. Otherwise, he'll walk over you. In other words, if you're not prepared to give up your job, Rumsfeld will go right at you. And it's sort of a strange phenomenon. Rumsfeld's personality, I always liked the guy. I've known him for about 30 years. And for the first 6 months after the Gulf War, these briefings, you would have thought he was Woody Allen. You know, everybody was just knocked out by him. He was the sex symbol.
Chipper, cheery.
Yeah, and he was, the transcript of the daily press briefings would be a question, Rumsfeld, answer, and then the next line would be laughter.
Quip.
Quip. Anyway, so there we are. Look, getting back to the war itself, and I really didn't give you a full answer to the question of stalemate.
Because that's a terribly disturbing kind of report to imagine all these troops over there sitting in the desert in a stalemate from which you quote people saying the only path they can see is retreat, if I got you right.
No, it's the hold back and wait for reinforcements. The go back means just to go back, and you don't want to be look, there's a tremendous pressure from this White House to take action. And I'm not sure what's happening. There's a lot of reports.
Reports of action being taken even as we speak.
But it's across a broad stretch. It's not necessarily driving on Baghdad. That would, at this point, I find it stunning that somebody would think we would go to Baghdad now, because we're 350 miles line now. The line of communication from Kuwait to the forces in the field is over 350 kilometers, 200 miles or so, and that's a supply line that's, you know, getting roughed up. The Fedayeen and others are hitting us, particularly at night. And I can just tell you, in the minds of some of the more senior people I know in this business, that would be adding to the risk. There's no likelihood of any serious relief available for 2 or 3 weeks. The 4th Division will be ready probably by mid-April, maybe a little bit later. And it'll be almost May before we can get, perhaps even into May, before we can get a full-scale offensive to go and try and attack Baghdad. And once we get to Baghdad, I have to tell you, the plan is still there in flux. We're probably going to siege the city and try and starve everybody out. Meanwhile, every town we're going to go to and every waterway, as they get closer to Baghdad, there's a lot of canals. Mm-hmm. A lot of bridges to go over, much more vegetation. You'll see it less desert, more lush. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be a very intense fighting, and it's going to be block by block. And right now what's happened in Basra was not in the package. What's happened in Karbala and other places, these places are very holy places, was not in the package. We weren't going to touch
to be
those.
Fighting there at all. Sire, stand by. I want to hear from Donald Rumsfeld this afternoon, speaking to this issue of who signed off on this war plan.
There haven't been delays in any major thing. Before this started, the president sat down in a secure video with General Franks and each of the component commanders before he made a decision to go forward. And he asked him a couple of questions. He said, is this war plan a good one, and will it win? And each single person, every component commander, they said directly to the president of the United States on a secure video, absolutely. Just listen. Then he said, do you have everything you need? Simple question. These are adults. They're all 4 stars. And they sat there and they looked at the president in the eye and said, absolutely, we've got everything we need.
Donald Rumsfeld this afternoon talking to reporter Cy Hirsch. How do you interpret this?
Oh, come on. And do I really have to tell you what would have happened to one of those 4-star generals if they'd said, no, sir, I need more at that moment?
When it was the final sign-off, sitting full dress before the president.
Yeah, that's not...
So how did it go? And when Rumsfeld says it's not his plan, it's Tommy Frank's plan, where does the truth needle lie?
Now look, Donald Rumsfeld overruled the best thinkers of the military. Let me tell you what else he did that I write about in this article. The other thing they wanted to do was put a lot, they wanted to pre-position, is the word they use in the military. They wanted to bring enough tanks and heavy vehicles for two, three, even four divisions and storm in Kuwait, in theater, they call it, so that they were there. We're talking about, you know, about 700-800 vehicles for each division, 3,000 vehicles. They wanted to bring them over on boats. They had 6 months to do it, plenty of time, so that when the war began, you had all you had to do was airlift people in and get in their cars or, you know, whatever they...
Hop in the Humvee and go.
And go. Right now, the fact of the matter is the 4th Division, they're all here. They can fly in, and the 1st Cavalry in Texas can fly in, but there's nothing for them to drive. And then they're going to have to...
Because the equipment's not there, and once it gets there, it still has to come out of the holds of ships, and we know what a small funnel that is.
And not only that, there was enough for one division, pre-position. They did pre-position enough tanks, but the division that's in the field took those. The 3rd came over without its stuff. That's out of Fort Stewart, Georgia. Right now in Fort Stewart are all the 3rd's tanks and guns. They used the ones that had been pre-positioned. They were so confident. The civilian leadership was so confident that this was going to be, you know, a 5-day war. And by the way, as far as I was concerned, I thought they were right. We all did. None of us had any reason to think this was going to happen. The fact that the Shiites resisted as strongly is surprising.
Well, that was the package. Sihir, stand by. I want to invite our callers in. There are a lot of them. David's calling from Rockport. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking the call.
Sure.
I haven't had a chance to read Mr. Hirsch's article. It just got our New Yorker. But I was curious. I read on one of their web blogs that one of the potential reasons for our light involvement initially is that we're using Iraq as a test for the potential of our military, so that if we can use a small force and make these precise strikes like we're supposed to, then we can move on to other areas like Korea and Iran. So in fact, Rumsfeld had bigger plans for our military, and they didn't want to sink everything into Iraq, but save it and see what we could do with a light force.
We've got it, David. My time is short before the brief, but thanks for your call. Cy Hirsch, was it necessary for Donald Rumsfeld to promote this light, fast, less expensive war to kind of sync up with the president's preemptive warfare strategy of a greater willingness to apply American power?
I don't think there's any question that down deep in the heart of Rumsfeld and the president and Cheney was the sense of a laboratory, and your caller is dead right.
Is that now standing disproved, or well, is it still too soon to say in this war?
That's an interesting issue. I mean, believe me, we're not going to see a mad pell-mell rush to Baghdad now. That's just not going to happen. Look, I could be wrong, but that's the. We all live on. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not going to bet my youngest on it. But my understanding is that's not in the cards, because we don't have enough forces in case of trouble. We don't have the reserves, and so we're in for months, I think, of fighting. I don't think this has become a religious war. The Shiites all over the world want to come in on behalf of Saddam, who suddenly now talks religious. He does a little bit of the religious talk.
Let's hope we can change that. Sihir, stand by. We've got to take a break. We're talking about the bitter battle over the war plan for Iraq in the Pentagon right now. Has a high-concept ideology left U.S. troops in the lurch? Or is all this just second-guessing way too early in the game? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about civil war at the Pentagon, light versus might, and the bitter battle over the war plan for Iraq, about the Rumsfeld juggernaut versus elements of the uniformed military who did not want to go light into Iraq. Our guest this hour is Seymour Hirsch, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. He's writing this week in The New Yorker in an article called Offense and Defense, that Donald Rumsfeld was deeply involved in the planning that led us to exactly where we are now. And he quotes... many military officers and intelligence sources, I have to say many of them unnamed, saying Rumsfeld got us into this. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Have Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and Cheney hijacked the U.S. military with a futuristic concept that doesn't work, or are stodgy military stick-in-the-muds using the difficulty of war to whack a reformist Secretary of Defense? We're at 1-800-423-8255. James is calling from Springsboro, Pennsylvania. Hi, James. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good evening.
Hi. I think Donald Rumsfeld and Cheney and the other one are definitely running this war. They haven't listened to anyone. They're doing the same thing that was done in Vietnam. I am a Vietnam vet, and I have three sons who are in the military.
Are they in Iraq now, James?
No, not yet, thankfully.
So what do you see going on in this war?
I see a lot. If I don't look for the break in the action and the hold off for Baghdad to happen, because Rumsfeld got his neck on the line, and he has to do something, and he's going to do it, and it's going to cost, I'm afraid it's going to cost a lot of American lives.
You think he'll push even without reinforcements behind him? James, thanks for your call. Seymour Hersh, can you picture that? At this point, everybody seems to be waiting for the reinforcements to at least get a lot closer than they are right now.
Well, I did hear that the president, not so much Rumsfeld, that the president wanted more action because he wanted to cut into this negativism that's that was over the weekend that was creeping in. And your caller, of course, the other point is we saw there was a widely publicized incident in the press today. It happened yesterday about the innocent shooting of some civilians. I can tell you the European press is full of other accounts of much more details, some very depressing. Our GIs are confronted with a guerrilla war like we had in Vietnam, where you can't really tell who's a combatant and who isn't, and they're frightened. There's been car bombs. They're not sure whether the person, even the child coming up to them, is potentially a menace. And when you get young kids who are scared and who expected a cakewalk and finding themselves in a very tough battle, there's nothing as dangerous as a 19-year-old guy with a weapon.
Would more troops have solved this? Might they still solve this, Sehersh?
Well, sure. I mean, can we win the war? I mean, if we get more troops and we reorganize and we improve the supply lines, and we march on Baghdad, and winning the war for us seems to be to depose Saddam. It's clear that there's going to be a lot of pressure, I think, from the Vatican, I think from the Russians, from other groups for a ceasefire that we're going to ignore. We're basically in unconditional surrender mode. And so once you get to Baghdad, which is going to be a bloody enough process, I have to tell you something about the Gulf War, just in terms of tanks. We repeatedly claimed in the Gulf War that we had destroyed as much as 50% of the Republican Guard tank units, even that brief, 3-4 day war.
Yep.
And after the war, we discovered we'd only destroyed about 15%. It's not clear. When we see newspaper accounts of 50% of the tanks destroyed, it's not clear how accurate these numbers are. They tend to reflect the reporting that, uncritical reporting of people who are making, claiming the kills. Mm-hmm. And they're always high, just like we had the same problem with the body count in Vietnam. At one point in the war, there were so many people had been reported dead that the Viet Cong were theoretically out of business. I mean, there were none left. They'd all been killed, but somebody kept them fighting. So you have to be a little skeptical about some of the press stuff you're seeing, not because reporters are misleading you, because they're just reflecting what they're being told and they're being misled. It's complicated. It's tough.
It's complicated, and it's a very, very tough view of it that you're laying out here, Sehersh. It's disturbing to take it on board, but we're listening. Will's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Will. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure.
I'm a Vietnam vet, and my company was almost wiped out on April 4th, 1966, because of bad strategy. And what I see here, from what I've been watching and listening to, is that we have a bunch of civilians that escaped going into the military that are running this, and they didn't listen to the people that had military experience.
You're talking about the top civilian officials in the
right,
Pentagon.
I'm talking about Richard Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz, Dick Cheney, George Bush, and Donald Rumsfeld.
So do you see fingerprints of military inexperience on what's going on in Iraq?
Yes, I do. I see it, and my heart goes out more for the troops than ever before. I've always been concerned about our young men and women going into combat. Mm. But at this point, it's worse, because when I see a supply train that's far behind the main body and they're getting hit, whether they're taking heavy casualties or not, it slows them down.
Yeah, it sure does, and we've seen the casualties there. Bill, thank you very much for your call from Madison. Seymour Hersh, where do you think this is headed? We heard earlier from John Diamond in Washington that there's also a layer of Vietnam-era veterans, officers still active in the military who say they're determined to speak up about what they actually see going on. If we're in a tight spot here, might there not be a kind of pushback that I don't know, could even lead to resignations?
Well, I don't know. You just don't know what's. I would think that in all of the time that's been going on now, there might have been more some overt dissent inside some of the brass, but it hasn't happened. One thing that the president has done, and Mr. Rove, his political advisor,
Karl Rove.
Yeah, we're all scared. We've been scared. They, you know, every time they get in trouble, they talk more about another terrorist threat. And, you know, Big Daddy's going to take care of us when that happens. We have a national government. We have to look for them for security. And that's always very unsettling. And so we're constantly given these alerts and made, you know, we did have a terrible thing happen. But we're, you know, I almost question sometimes whether some of these alerts aren't politically intended. But certainly I think the long road is down the war is that by mid-May, when the temperature is going to be, what, 110, 120 there, we're going to have, you know, three or four divisions outside of Baghdad, if all goes well, and we're going to siege the city. We're going to blockade it, and we're going to starve out the people, among them, hopefully, Saddam Hussein. And that's a policy. I can tell you right now, the world is inflamed by what's going on. Your caller mentioned the boys. One of the things that I think made the guys speak to me, the story I did was released, I guess, Saturday night and started a food frenzy, obviously. Mm-hmm. The guys who spoke to me were speaking because they were young, a few great officers, majors, lieutenant colonels, colonels, had been with troops, and they, like all good officers, and we have an awful lot of good officers, they really care about the troops in terms of sort of in loco parentis. These are their children. And they're, as your caller said again, they're out there now. And they're scared. They haven't been relieved. We've all seen World War II movies. At a critical moment in the World War II movie, the company is told, guys, you're relieved. Go back and get a shower, a good night's sleep, have a hot meal and apple pie and ice cream and, you know, and take a break.
Take a break, boys. You deserve it.
Right. Go to the Bisco and you know, but they're not getting a break. These guys are two, three hours a night sleeping. They've been on the line for 11, 12 days. Most textbooks in the military will tell you after 3 days the efficiency of any group goes down precipitously. They haven't been relieved. They're not going to talk straight to the embedded reporters. And if they did, the embedded reporters would be, you know, chary about reporting what they're hearing because that would get them unembedded.
Well, Sir Hersh, I have to say it's a lot easier on the ear to believe the line from the Pentagon, but you're laying out an awful lot here to think about, to chew on, and an awful lot of it is arresting, to say the least, and depressing. But we're glad you're digging at it. Seymour Hersh, if you'll stand by, I want to listen together with you to a bit of tape here from a speech earlier today. In March, Seymour Hersh wrote a tough report on potential conflicts of interest of Pentagon advisor Richard Perle. Last week, Perle resigned his position as the influential chairman of the Defense Policy Board. He remains a member of that board. Just 2 hours ago at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, Richard Perle defended the war with Iraq in a panel discussion. There were anti-war protesters both inside and outside the auditorium as he spoke. Here's an excerpt where Perle suggests that the United Nations is outdated.
The UN and the Security Council structure in particular were established in response to a war that began with aggression across national borders. And that was the preoccupation of the founders of the United Nations. And for half a century, anyway, that was the principal concern, that the Soviet Union might cross national borders, as indeed it sometimes did, or that others might cross national borders and launch aggressive wars. But the threat we face today, the threat all of us in this room face, is not that there is going to be an aggression across national borders. It could happen, but most of us are not concerned about that. The threat we face today is that some lunatic will get his hands on a weapon of mass destruction and use it to kill as many people as he can, as many Americans as he can, if he can possibly reach our territory and detonate that weapon. Now, that is the kind of threat that takes shape entirely, up until it's too late to do anything about it, entirely within the confines of a single nation, perhaps. I don't believe the UN Security Council structure is a structure for the threats of the 21st century. Peacekeeping, fine. Humanitarian assistance, fine. Food and agriculture, world health, fine. But when it comes to protecting the citizens of this country and others in other countries, the Security Council has not designed a mechanism that is appropriate, and even if it tried to be effective, I don't believe it can be as it is presently constituted. So what do we do about that? My preference... My preference, others may have other views, would be to convene a new charter conference for the United Nations and see whether we can reconstitute the United Nations so as to recognize the terrorist threat and so as to empower the international community to deal with it, to organize military action when necessary, even if no border has been crossed, where the existential threat of weapons of mass destruction in the hands of rogue states or terrorists can be dealt with by the international community. Until that time, no American president, left, right, or center, will have any choice but to use the power of the United States when there is a threat that cannot be dealt with effectively by the international community.
Pentagon advisor and one of the architects of the war in Iraq, Richard Perle, speaking at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, just hours ago. Seymour Hersh, your article on Richard Perle was certainly one of the things that led to him resigning the chairmanship of that Defense Policy Board. He called it a masterpiece of falsehood and innuendo. But here Richard Perle is tonight still ringing the basic alarm here. Maybe we'll talk about the UN, but his basic point is some lunatic, he says, will get weapons of mass destruction and it will be too late and we'll pay a terrible price. We have to act now. He's still putting that message out.
Almost. It's really nice to be the 800-pound gorilla, isn't it? I love his definition of, the threat is, the real concern isn't some lunatic will lead across a border and invade another country. He said, that's not our concern anymore. It seems to be to describe what we're doing, but look.
But what about that core concern? There are many Americans still very worried about it.
Terrorism's a part of the world. It's been, go tell the French with Algeria, go tell the Brits with the IRA. We're the first country to think that terrorism hitting us is such a terrifying fact that we have to go and change the whole world in our image and go root out the people we think that are potential threats, whether they really are or not.
Nuclear weapons, smallpox, World Trade Center coming down, looks pretty big scale.
Yep, well, the point being that, the answer to Richard Perle's, This is fear talk. They're frightened. These are frightened people. They don't want to deal with the root causes of terrorism, which may be in places, certainly in Israel and Palestine, at least one of the issues. They don't want to deal with the inequities of most of the Middle Eastern nations, where to be poor is to be consigned to the slag heap. It's not hard to see why you have a lot of revolutionaries and politically religious revolutionaries. There's a lot of solace found in religion. There are ways to deal with this, short of deciding that we have to declare jihad ourselves against any threat or perceived threat.
Seymour Hersh, with that, we're out of time, but we thank you enormously for joining us tonight and for all your work. Keep it up. Thanks for joining us.
Bye-bye.
Seymour Hersh is investigative journalist and Pulitzer Prize-winning contributor to The New Yorker. For continuing coverage of the war in Iraq, go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Support.